Hello, I'm Michael Heyman, and you're listening to Changemakers. Now, joining us from Hong Kong today is my guest, James Chen, the global activist and philanthropist. Prolific, committed, and impact-driven, James has used his wealth to address issues that matter. He's created Clearly, which is a campaign to help the 2.2 billion people around the world living with vision challenges. And this has also seen him work in a highly successful and innovative public-private collaboration to deliver vision to the nation of Rwanda. It's all part of a smart giving approach, which he calls catalytic philanthropy. And alongside this is a commitment to other issues such as childhood literacy. And in his quieter moments, he's even found time to back a major new Netflix documentary about the story of the Paralympic Games. James, welcome to Changemakers. Let's get started with this gold medal story. Rising Phoenix is, I believe, the name of the documentary. Tell us more.
Well, as you mentioned, Rising Phoenix is a story about the Paralympics. It's an amazing, fascinating story that talks about the beginnings and how it was founded by a Professor Ludwig Gutmann, and it's the challenges not only amongst the athletes, which is unbelievably stimulating, but also about the movement and the challenges that the Paralympics Games have had. You know, for example, in 2016, they nearly did not have the Paralympic Games, which is absolutely shocking. But very, very lucky. So a lot of drama involved, and just an absolutely wonderful storyline.
I mean, the producer, Greg Nugent, spoke recently about the struggle to get funding for a story about disability. Why did you pick up the baton in terms of actually getting stuck in and actually backing that with your own funds?
Well, that, I guess, I've known Greg. He's been absolutely an amazing guy, him and his team. They've helped me on my Clearly campaign. So I really know them and trust their judgment. That's number one. This is exactly a story, you know, about disabilities. And frankly, when Greg first approached me about this, I had to say I scratched my head a little bit. But once he told me about the history and all the, you know, the backstory of the Paralympics, and, you know, I was captivated, and I just really felt this had to be a story that had to be told, and so therefore it's something that I was very, very proud and honored actually to have a chance to participate in the making of this movie in a very small way.
Now, I noted that your top tip for life was that luck happens to those who are prepared. How lucky is the world right now, do you think, James?
Well, I mean, you know, it's the glass is half empty or half full, right? And I think that, this pandemic is terrible and very challenging, disruptive to most people. But it's also perhaps a wake-up call that, you know, I think the period before this, there's been a lot of, brouhaha, I'm not sure what's the right term, but it's something that really, perhaps, the Great Gatsby-ish going on. And in a way, this is a kind of a bit of maybe nature's way of saying, you know, time to have a reality check. And I think hopefully it becomes a grounding experience. And actually going back to the movie, this is a, you know, amongst all this challenges, you know, to have a movie like this, this story about the Paralympians and Paralympics, it really, really brings out that, you know, however difficult we think life is, you know, there are challenges, but there's also so many opportunities. And that's really what comes through in that story of the Paralympics.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's right. I mean, interesting that you mentioned the Great Gatsby, because the family that has inspired you most has been the Rockefeller family, which of course, you know, found its heyday in the roaring 20s of the last century. In terms of that kind of high impact philanthropy, that multi-generational family, give us a sense of how that works in your own situation. You're part of a multi-family story as well.
Well, yeah, I'm a third generation member of a business family. The Rockefellers, of course, is now, I think, in their seventh or eighth generation, and for the Chinese, I think there's a very deep sense of family, right? And so this idea of generations and being able to pass down. You know, typically, you know, it's we think about financial wealth, but more importantly, I think it's about, you know, values, about how to be live person to live life and being a person that lives to its fullest and a responsible member of society. And that's where I very, very much find that the Rockefeller family, through the generations, you know, and through their philanthropy, has done some amazing, incredible work. And in those times where I've had the pleasure and honor of meeting some of the family members, you know, their sense of humility really comes through. And it's from a sense of saying, you know, even though they are born to privilege, you know, they understand their responsibilities to society and to their families. And that's something that resonates very well with myself and I think for the Chinese culture.
I certainly took out of their story and your story the commitment to focus. It's not just about writing checks. It's about actually getting into the lane of the cause that you want to make a difference to. Now, you call that catalytic philanthropy in terms of the, I guess, the risk-taking approach of the entrepreneur meets the, you know, the, I guess, the societal change that charities and others want to achieve. Unpack that a little bit for us in terms of what people can take out of that as an approach to life.
Yeah, so you know, we in this world, you know, it's I think everyone would agree that we face so many challenges, right? And there are no easy answers to this, right? But the reality is there are people working on these issues right at the front line, and they are the ones who are most likely to understand, hey, what works and what doesn't work, and what are some ideas to really, you know, change things, right? But typically, how do they get the funding to test these ideas, right? And that's where I think there's the system is broken, right? There's not enough funding in these early to try these early stage ideas to see it if they actually work or don't work. And if they do work, that's the opportunity to scale up. And that's where private high net worth can really, really make a difference. We're unique. It's a superpower of the high net worth community to be able to take risk and back these high risk ideas.
And you talked about I read privatizing failure and socializing success. Is that really what this is about?
Yes, indeed. You know, we have, as the high net worth philanthropic community, we have the opportunity to be able to take risks. And, you know, with risk, you know, comes failure. And we can afford, because it's our money, right, that we're dealing with, that we can afford to take those risks and to accept the failures, which, for example, governments and even corporates tend to struggle with, because the people who are making those decisions tend to be agents of the capital owners, i.e. taxpayers or shareholders, right? So it's much more difficult to them to make those decisions. Whereas for us, you know, if we see something interesting and we think it's a game changer, we can take a risk on that. And if it fails, it's our money. But if it succeeds, that's where, you know, we can then offer it to the world, to governments and corporates to help scale up, right? And that's how the idea of socializing success.
So what's been a failure for you in terms of things you've invested in?
I think, you know, the way I put it is that, you know, we're on a big life journey, and within this life journey, there are all these other journeys you can choose to go on. I've, you know, chosen to go on a journey around, you know, the access to vision correction, and in this, you know, there's been lots of, it's been 16, going on 17 years now that I've been working on this issue, and so you can imagine along the way, you know, it's not been smooth sailing, but there's been lots of challenges. For example, trying to convince, for example, the World Bank to help us fund the projects early on, and realizing that no, this is not the way the world works, you know, and oftentimes this is learning the hard way how things don't work, And yet, you know, being continue to be committed to this idea of, hey, why can't it work better? Why can't we do this? And until somebody gives me a good answer to that question, or I figure out for myself, right, then I'm not willing to stop. And that's the perseverance of saying, you know, if there's a, there seems to me there is a good reason that something can be done. In this case of that I've been working on with access to vision correction, it's been something that that's taken this long journey, but lots of failures and successes along the way. And the journey is not over.
The journey's not over. And so vision is what you would describe as a domain expertise, isn't it? I suppose for you, something that you know about, you care about, an area you can really focus on. Tell us a little bit about the key pillars of that. Clearly, Vision for a Nation in Rwanda. These, I guess, are central investments where you've delivered real impact.
Yes. So when I started on this journey, all I knew was that I needed glasses since I was a teenager. And so this is something that is very personal to me, right? And then realizing, because I've grown up in Africa and spent a lot of my career in developing Asia, I could also see that very few people had glasses. And it always struck me, is it because they don't need glasses or they don't have access? Now I know, of course, that it's the issue is that they don't have access to glasses. So out of the 2.2 billion people in the world today suffering from or struggling with poor vision, 90% can have their vision corrected by a simple pair of glasses. And so this is the journey I've been going on. You know, what are those barriers that keep people from getting access to glasses?
And presumably there's a major economic benefit, not just a social one, in terms of why governments and nations around the world need to address this as a priority matter.
That's why we started the Clearly campaign, is that we realized that this issue can be solved, but it takes political will. And so the Clearly campaign has been advocating with policymakers and government leaders as to that this issue is solvable, and the impact on the sustainable development goals that they've committed to, i.e. productivity increases, you know, good jobs, better educational outcomes, even gender equality, these all will not be achieved if the vision of 2.2 billion people are not first corrected. So we term this this issue as an SDG accelerator.
I mean, I'm reading a piece of your research here that from 2018 that found a pair of glasses could increase the productivity of Indian tea pickers by up to 31.6%. I mean, it's a sort of, I suppose that's also a big part of it. Now, just going back there, you mentioned that this is something that obviously you wear glasses, I wear glasses. Your personal story here, I believe, starts with a driving test, was it not, in terms of your realization of just how important 20/20 vision was?
That's right. I did not realize I had poor vision until I was studying in upstate New York in high school, and I went, you know, very excited to have a chance to go take a driving test. And the first thing they do is give you an eye test, and I failed that. And so I went to, you know, the local optical shop, got my eyes checked, and got glasses, and it's like, wow, okay, so this is what I've been missing. And that's why this makes it such a personal mission for me, is that, you know, for better part of 16 years, you know, I'd been going around life, you know, not aware. And this is something that most people who are struggling with poor vision, they don't know what they're not seeing.
But I also think that it's interesting when you observe philanthropists, there are those that will write a wide array of checks for a range of good causes. And I suppose and that's fine. But there are also those that are very driven people with a sense of a goal and a sense of achievement that they want to deliver. In terms of how you find your purpose, how you find your issue, is there a learnable lesson for others in the way that you found yours, in terms of, well, actually, if I was to sit down now and vision board the things I want to make a difference to, what's the first question you should ask yourself?
Well, I think the first thing is there an issue that you see, there's something that's not, that you feel is not right, that you feel that you can actually do something about it, or, you know, or try to, you know, we, of course, when you start on these journeys, we don't know whether we can make a difference, right? But my hypothesis, and it's worked for me, is that if you stick with it, that's this idea of developing domain expertise. And when you actually, you know, try taking risks, you know, backing unconventional ideas and seeing how they work or they fail, then it informs and builds that domain expertise. And then over time, you know, that's how you find that you step back and go, wait a minute, I'm actually now the domain expert in this particular topic.
Mm. I mean, the other area where you've achieved real distinction is in addressing the issue of childhood literacy through the Chen Yat-sen Family Foundation, your family foundation, which I suppose is also the baton being passed from your father, Robert, to you in terms of a family issue that sort of means something. Tell us a little bit more about that.
Yes. Yeah, so, you know, my late father was really, truly the inspiration for me on my philanthropic journey. What he did in his lifetime was to go back to a community where he grew up in, where he himself experienced famine as a child. And when he made it in business and retired, he went back there and tried to ensure that, you know, particularly in education, that children would have the best available education, and he supported that. So it, for him, it wasn't just about giving the money, it was actually about understanding the issue and really putting personal time and effort to improve the lot of those children. And that was very inspiring. And so when the time came for me, the baton to be passed to me, it really informed the way that I approach giving. It's not about just writing checks. It is about putting your time and effort into understanding the needs and the issues. And perhaps I've taken this kind of forward a bit more by you know, this idea of taking high risks and backing unconventional ideas to see if they work. And if they do, is how do you then go about scaling it, right?
I mean, you mentioned family at the beginning of the interview, and I'm sort of thinking that, you know, the story of global philanthropy today is, you know, Bill and Melinda Gates, people that have made wealth very quickly in a single generation. Do you think that a family that has, I guess, prospered over the generations, that may well take a view where time has a slightly different dimension to them, does that provide you with a different perspective, a different approach, do you think, to philanthropy than perhaps somebody that has gone fast, broken things quickly, and then has money to make a difference very, very speedily?
Yeah, I would say, you know, yeah. In fact, to me, you know, I mean, I hugely admire Bill Gates, but he's probably more an anomaly than the norm. The norm would, I think, be more like the Rockefeller family, where the first generation makes the wealth, and it's kind of the second, third, and fourth generation onwards that actually made the impact on philanthropy, right? And this is something that is should be learned by most families, that this is a multi-generational undertaking, that and where, you know, you have the wealth creator, and there may be others in the following generation who are wealth creators, but there's opportunities for other family members who are passionate about philanthropy to be able to take these high risk approach to philanthropy.
And do you have a sense of responsibility in terms of how you prepare future generations after yourself to when you hand on that baton, I guess?
Yes, I think that also informs the work that myself and my wife do, that, you know, because we really try to pass on to the kids this idea that, you know, we not only should benefit, you know, have all the goodies from the wealth, but we have a responsibility to society, right? And so you know, are by being able to for them to see the kind of work that we do and how challenging and difficult, but also, you know, meaningful it is, that I hope that those lessons, you know, as the Americans say, you know, what we're trying to do is not just talk the talk, but we're walking the walk.
Walking the walk now. Another area of where you walk is, I can't finish this interview without walking you into food, because everybody I speak to about James Chen will say to me, talk to him about food. You're an investor in restaurants in New York, in Hong Kong. Give us a very brief overview of what you're investing in and why.
Yeah, it's something that, you know, I enjoy good food, and it's just something that I've been curious about from early age. I started cooking when I was very young myself, and so throughout my life, and particularly the career, I've had the opportunity to invest in restaurants, and they were disasters all along. Particularly, you know, the first series of restaurants, all of them went completely.
What sort of restaurants were they? Were they kind of fine dining? Were they
New England country cooking? At one point we were I was a shareholder partner in one of the most successful nightclubs in Hong Kong that also had a very nice cafe involved, you know, but all of these ventures failed, and it, you know, but yet, you know, because of my interest and passion, you know, very personal to me, you know, I continue to try to, you know, learn, what did I do wrong? You know, why did we fail that time? Why do we fail this time? You know, and ultimately, I was very lucky that I ran into an absolutely brilliant lady, Bonnie Coxon, and together we opened a restaurant called Seva in Hong Kong, which has paid for all of my previous failures. It's very unique. It's her recipes. You know, she's a very a global citizen, I guess, like myself, and she's just got incredibly good taste. It's not just about the food; it's about the ambiance and the whole experience, including the music, right? And so she's done such an amazing job. And you know how it is. Once you think you've got the formula down, then you kind of say, "Ooh, now that I've got one success, maybe I can replicate it." And that's how I then had the opportunity to work with David Chang of Momofuku, and so I was one of his first two outside investors in the Momofuku group of restaurants.
I mean, it strikes me your life is very much this kind of global travel. I mean, you're investing in things, making a difference in things. I guess the thing that I've always observed in you, James, is a kind of a positivity and an optimism that you can make a difference. In these sort of, like, you know, very dark days for the world, where we are struggling with so many issues, how does the light of the optimist stay bright?
Well, I think history has shown that, you know, this too shall pass, right? And so we have to look beyond the present challenges. You know, when the times were great, you know, that's not a time to go crazy, right? And when times are bad, that's not a time to lose faith. And so I think that being, you know, I guess perhaps I'm a bit of a contrarian, but I feel I'm very much a person who says the glass is half full, and really look to, you know, the so many amazing opportunities out in the world today. And in fact, my biggest challenge probably is to stop myself from getting involved with more things. My wife always says to me, she says, you know, well, you have all these big ideas. You know, you do the 1% inspiration. I have to do the 99% perspiration. So cut it out, you know, deliver on some of these things before you take on something else.
Love it. I mean, I have to say, so many of our guests see themselves through the lens of the contrarian, and and I think that does speak to the entrepreneurial attitude. It speaks to the innovative mindset, I think it's so much about what change makers really are. But that's unfortunately all we have time for this episode. And my thanks to James Chen, very much as you've heard it, a passionate philanthropist with an appetite for action and getting things done. I think we've heard a story about focus on what and where you can make the difference, be the catalyst, be the change, stay in lane. Join me for the next Changemakers.